Hi, I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we've been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
Which is what prompted us to start this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hi everyone, we've been away a little while we're reorganising slightly, but it's great to be back and it's very important and we're very grateful to you for listening. If this podcast sounds a little strange, it's because there's some men laying carpet above our heads, so there may be the occasional bang.
And we've been working really hard to improve our sound and then we've been thwarted by men laying carpet.
That's right. And one of the things that because we have this new platform, we're very anxious to make it even better and the podcast even better. And for that, and as I always say, we're incredibly grateful to you for listening and we hope you enjoy it. Mo, you've been away.
I have been away. I went on holiday to Tunisia. Encouraged by your trips to Tunisia.
Yes, but you
apart from mine was not the same as what you do.
You didn't get the best of weather. I'm sorry.
No, it rained nearly all the time I was there.
Well, it was warm rain.
It was warm rain. Yeah, yes. No, it was nice.
It is actually a nice place and terribly nice people.
Oh yeah, the people were so nice.
They're really gentle people, and you know, you went to Sousse where there was that dreadful attack. And people were put off, and it's so sad for the Tunisians, whom I feel very strongly for.
Yeah, no, I did chat to a few of them about that. It was very sad.
You know, they had done nothing, and you can't prevent the madman, just as you couldn't prevent the men on London Bridge, or indeed in Manchester Arena.
Yeah, or in Paris.
Or in Paris or Nice, yeah. Or, you know, any of those attacks.
Yeah.
And it had a catastrophic effect on Tunisian economy, because it depends so much on tourism.
I know.
And it was just, they were trying to destabilise the regime. That was what was going on. But nevertheless.
Well, let's not get into the
politics. Let's not get into the politics. Exactly.
I don't think we've got the time.
Only one thing I should say before we start this one is that I did a live gig in Manchester, Secrets of Serial Killers, which I played an extraordinary place called the Frog and Bucket, which is a comedy club. And I found myself in the dressing room surrounded by pictures of famous comedians who signed, I played the frog and bucket.
That's
now,
funny.
For a man who's talking about Ted Bundy, Frederick West and Levi Belfield, amongst others.
Bit incongruous.
It was a very strange, but they were tremendous, lovely audience, very, very nice place, great venue. And I was astonished. They were very enthusiastic. They asked very interesting questions. They bought books. They were really, really nice people.
That's great, Dad. I'm really glad it was a success.
It was, and yes, and I think this is the third live show I've done. And I'm going to do some more, I hope. And I've learned a lot every time about what you need to do and how you need to do it. And one of the things that I've learned is it's quite important to say something obvious, like who you are. You know, not every walks into the room knows who the heck I am.
Oh, yeah.
Very simple, but straightforward point. You know, so I remind them that I've got a podcast and I remind them I do television documentaries and I remind them that I've written books. And in a way, it sounds the most obvious thing to do, but in a way, it's the most important.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, I hope everybody who's listening knows who you are, but we can recap on that any time. Or go to Geoffrey's website.
You go to my website, geoffreywansell.com. But perhaps at the end, we'll recap a little about exactly what I've done.
Yes, okay. Well, we're going to get on with it. So I recently found myself catching up with the craze that everyone else already was caught up with by watching all the seasons of Peaky Blinders, which I was obsessed with, and Cillian Murphy's amazing. And so off the back of that, I asked Dad if we could do an episode, which we're going to call The Real Peaky Blinders, so we can find out about the real Peaky Blinders.
And that's exactly what we're about to do. The Real Peaky Blinders is quite different from the television series, though I thought the television series was utterly wonderful. In reality, there was a gang known as the Peaky Blinders. But let's get rid of a few of the myths very early on. They didn't have razor blades sewn into the front of their caps.
Yeah, I read that.
because believe it or not, when the Peaky Blinders came into existence, almost certainly in 1890, the razor blade hadn't reached this country. The one you put into a little razor, it didn't get here till 1908. And the Gillette Company, who had the founders of the razor blade industry, had only started in America a couple of decades earlier. So that has always been a myth. It was a myth perpetuated by an English writer called John Douglas in a book in 1977 called A Walk Down Summer Lane. And in a sense, he perpetuated the myth of the cap as a weapon. It was certainly a means of disguise, because if you pulled it down far enough, people couldn't recognise your face. They could only see, you know, the lower half of your face. So that was always a little bit of a myth.
Oh, is that why it was called Peaky Blinders then? Because
the peak,
the peak blind, you couldn't see who they were.
That's right.
Rather than they were cutting people's eyes out.
Absolutely, and indeed, blinder is a Birmingham term for someone who is well dressed and dapper.
I mean, they are very well dressed.
Yes,
that is definitely
the pin under the tie,
yeah.
The cap, the overcoat,
waistcoat, suit,
maybe a chain on the waistcoat. That is Birmingham slang. Is a blinder.
I'm really into the short trousers and boots combo.
Yes, that. But so what you've got really is a description of the way they looked: peaked cap, nattily dressed. Hence the name Peaky Blinder. When the creator of the show, Stephen Knight, talked about it at the very beginning, he said that he wanted to be larger than life, and which is, in a sense, it's exactly that. He also changed the time zone. The real original Peaky Blinders were before the First World War.
Mm.
But because Knight wanted to make a point about the impact the trenches had had on people who'd served in the trenches.
I think that's really interesting.
And the appetite for violence, he shifted it to 1919. Now, there were remnants of the Peaky Blinders left in 1919, but not as well organised. Right. The other thing that's interesting is that they weren't really into organised crime in the way that he portrayed it. Organised crime, gangs, really didn't develop in this country, in England, and Scotland until about 1930 in Glasgow and Sheffield.
Oh, really?
So it wasn't quite the same. But we'll come back to that.
Okay.
We'll come back to that. So essentially what you've got is you've altered the time frame. You've picked up on this wonderful slang, which is very good. And I think that what the show is trying to do, and in this respect it does represent what the Peaky Blinders were like. If you put Peaky Blinders into your search engine...
My phone device.
Yes.
If I just Google Peaky Blinders...
Yes, you will get the television series, but you'll also get the original, real Peaky Blinders.
Hold on a second.
No, it's not. I can talk while you're doing.
Just type in Peaky...
In fact, the most powerful of the real Peaky Blinders was a man called Kevin Mooney, although his real name was actually Thomas Gilbert. He used many aliases. He was the oldest at 38 of a gang based in Small Heath in Birmingham. They were all linked with an attack on a man called George Eastwood in March 1890, at the Rainbow Public House in Adderley Street in Birmingham. There were basically five of them. Thomas Gilbert, known as Kevin Mooney, David Taylor, Ernest Bayliss, Harry Babyface Fowler, and Stephen McHickey. If you look on you'll see pictures of them.
Just bringing up. I'm going to put real Peaky Blinders.
Yes, good idea.
I'm just getting...
You're just getting the television show at the moment.
Oh, here we go.
Yes. You see the pictures?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, here, these lads.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
They're not really.
They're a motley looking crew, aren't they? I mean, they definitely are. Not as handsome as Cillian Murphy.
No, or John Anderson, or anybody else.
Paul Anderson,
sorry.
Peaky Blinders, Small Heath.
Yes.
Well, we'll put a picture of them on our social media at some point.
But the interesting thing is that originally they weren't the first Birmingham street gang. The original Birmingham street gang, who were nearby, were the Sloggers. And in the end, it developed into a battle between the Sloggers, who'd been there about 20 years, and the Blinders, who were late on the scene
and
in 1890.
When you say battle, what were they battling for? Being in charge of the area?
Yeah, it was partly, obviously, protection, you know, shopkeepers.
And will you be the same as in the telly programme, like with them running the pubs and stuff like that?
Siphoning off money.
Yeah.
But basically, we'll protect your pub against the windows being broken or fights breaking out, providing you pay us.
Okay.
Because if you don't pay us, fights will break out and we'll break the windows.
Okay.
It's the oldest scam in the book, really. And it's an exercise in extortion. Let's not glamorise it at all. You're extorting people and you're using violence to do it. But they weren't. If you contrast them with the Glasgow gangs, say, post the Second World War, who resorted to open cutthroat razors, they were not as violent. They had a lot of fights, a lot of fists.
Fisticuffs, but less.
But not so much cutting. They did use knives on occasions. Well, imagine the scene. I mean, let's paint a little picture. You have cobbled streets, narrow alleys, gas lighting, and filth on the streets. You really have a very poor area of Birmingham, second biggest city in the country, in England. Lots of shadows, a lot of very cheap gin, the penny of gin. And people haven't got much to hang on to. You've got a lot of economic problems. Yes, of course, the Industrial Revolution has drawn people into the city, and so you've got lots of manufacturing. Birmingham Small Arms, my first ever bicycle was called a BSA, Birmingham Small Arms. The Industrial Revolution...
There was a lot of industry there.
Had drawn people into, and they were living in very close proximity to one another.
Working in factories.
Back-to-back houses.
Yeah.
Not a lot of money. A good deal, in fact, a great deal of effectively child poverty. And you had people who had an ambition, and I'm not glamorising them for a moment, who had the ambition to get themselves out of the cycle of depression and deprived life that they were found themselves in.
Yeah, well, that seems fair enough, but they just used illegal and violent.
Yes, but again, I would not putting them, I'm not seeking to glamorise them, but we aren't talking about people who resorted to guns or machetes or stabbing. Yes, occasionally they did use a knife, and occasionally they did things that were absolutely illegal. But
so they didn't shoot people, they didn't have guns?
Indiscriminately, no. Of course, there were rivalries. And
did they do gambling rackets and stuff, or was that just in the telly programme?
No, to some extent it was. There was never... Cillian Murphy's character, Tommy Shelby, did not exist. There was no Shelby brothers.
No.
There was, however, Billy Kimber.
Did he run the race courses then?
Yes. And essentially, the race course gang, Billy Kimber's, had a very much longer life than the Peaky Blinders, because the race course gangs, which essentially were there to protection racket for bookmakers, if you want to keep all your winnings.
But weren't the bookmakers, weren't they sort of Kimber's bookmakers?
Well, some were.
Or they under him, as it were?
Some were, but not all were.
Oh, okay.
So the ones that weren't were encouraged to join, if you like, his group, his affiliation, because that way you could be sure that your proceeds weren't going to be stolen on the way up when you were leaving the course, because we were talking about big bags of money.
They're just carrying loads of cash around.
Pound notes. And it, you know, in those days there was no ATM. You carried your takings with you in a big bag.
Yeah. And so it's easy for people to rob you.
Sure. And the other thing that they did on the race courses was, because people were out to have a good time, they were maybe drank a little bit more than they would. Lots of pickpocketing. Lots and lots of pickpocketing.
And were those pickpockets part of his gang also?
Yes, run by him.
Okay.
So you have got a real Billy Kimber, who really did run a gang. First of all, called the Brummagem Boys, and then eventually Birmingham Boys. But the Peaky Blinders really operated, and that's where the time change is so significant. They really operated until the First World War. The First World War took away so many men from every city in Britain.
Everywhere,
every village. You've only got to go to any village and you'll find the war memorial with the names of the people who went away, often entire families wiped out in the trenches of Flanders. I think it's a very interesting idea to have moved it.
I mean, it works very well as a plot device.
Yes, but the reality was
they were end of the Victorian time.
Edwardian.
Yeah.
And I think that some of that nattiness, that you know, blinder look, can very much be attributed to Edwardian England, because it was the expression of Edward the VII, really.
Yeah.
Who was natty, if rather large, a very nice and avuncular figure, the only monarch ever to win the Derby.
The only one?
The only one. I have a poster in my bedroom of his horse Minoru, which won in 1909.
Oh.
The only reigning monarch ever.
Isn't that a silk scarf?
It is a silk scarf, yes. They make silk scarves to commemorate the wins. I think, just to go back for a minute to weapons, they all wore metal-tipped boots, which were very familiar at the end of the 19th century.
You mean like a steel toe cap?
A steel toe cap.
Like builders wear?
Yes. They all wore metal-tipped boots.
Like cobnail boots?
Yes. But they also used their belt buckles a lot.
Okay.
As weapons.
Yeah.
And sometimes, but rarely, knives. They were essentially, how can one put it, Victorian gangsters, but in a very minor key way.
Yeah, well, I suppose as well, before did you have as much access to weaponry before the war as you did afterwards?
No, you didn't.
Because that would have a lot to do, because you know how they get access in the show to like all these guns and you wouldn't. I suppose more would be when they go and they take weapons with them, like that look like homemade, like sticks with nails poking out of them and stuff
But that's almost as old as the Highland clearances. You know, the Highlanders took weapons that they'd made at home.
Yeah,
literally.
But then after the war, that's when people got guns, and
there was much more availability, and also people had become familiar with them. If you'd been in the trenches in Flanders, you'd had to use your Lee Enfield rifle or a handgun, and you'd got used to it. And that's, in a sense, the impact of the drama of the First World War, the trenches in Flanders, had washed back into the culture. And you had, of course, gun manufacturing for the first time on an industrial scale.
Yeah.
Because there hadn't really been a significant war on English or near English soil for more than 100 years. So you have...
Yeah, because during the Victorian era, all our wars were just us taking over. There's only the Crimean War, wasn't there?
Yes. Well, we did.
And before that was...
Napoleonic
Wars.
Yeah. So, you know, you didn't have the Franco-Prussian War as they had in Germany. It was a different society, very much more hierarchical. I think one of the other things that's interesting about the show is it reflects, and I think that it gets absolutely right, that there was a very hierarchical society. The elder mother or aunt had a great sway over the family. The father would often be seen as not as significant. It's a very matriarchal.
Well, it wasn't, or not around, maybe.
No, a lot not. But if you got, if you'd come back, and this great compliment to the Stephen Knight and to the show, if you've come back from the war, there aren't very many men back. You know, there are very few. And what's so fascinating is that I think what it gets absolutely right is the sense that we all have to stick together. We've been together in the trenches. We have to stick together now. That's the only way to survive.
They definitely look out for each other, don't they?
That's the only way we can survive. In a hostile environment in which everybody wants to steal our territory, we have to protect ourselves. And the only way to protect ourselves is to stick firmly together in a hierarchical family structure.
And so when they were in their gang, did they kill people?
Well, no, is the honest answer to that. I think the worst, I think one of the five originals, I think the worst he was ever convicted of was stealing a bicycle. They weren't.
So were there threats of violence, but it certainly wasn't.
No, it wasn't. And we're not talking about Al Capone. We're not talking about any of the, you know, 10 most Dillinger or any of the 10 most wanted in America. We're talking about basically, it's not small town, but it's a small group, small area of Birmingham. And it's a battle which in the end is destined to be crushed by the Depression. The only thing that remains are the racecourse gangs. And interestingly, the racecourse gangs continued throughout the 30s and into just after the war, 1948.
Well, they didn't go to the First World War.
No. The racecourse gangs, there was some called the Sabinis, were not really crushed until 1948.
That's so interesting. So during the First World War, did a lot of criminals not just join up?
Well,
you know, if there were a bunch of guys running racecourses during the First World War, that must mean that those criminals,
they'd escaped the call-up.
Yeah, they didn't go to war.
Well, that would be true. Some certainly made excuses, but an awful lot did go to war.
But I suppose if you're a criminal and you lived on the fringes of society anyway, it would be a bit different getting called up, would it?
Yes.
Again,
I think we're now getting slightly confused between what the Peaky Blinders were like, say, in 1890, when they were fighting the Cheapside Sloggers, and what the Peaky Blinders were like in the television series, which is after the war.
Yeah, no, I know, I understand.
So, but what I'm saying is that, funnily enough, Graham Greene, of whom I'm a great admirer, wrote a novel in 1937 called Brighton Rock, in which he featured a gangster.
Pinky?
No.
Oh, Pinky's not a gangster.
Pinky? Not Peaky.
No, Pinky.
Pinky.
I said Pinky.
You did?
Yeah.
And
Pinky's a gangster, right?
Pinky's a gangster.
I'm not a totally.
Okay. So Pinky was, I mean, Green happened to meet a member of the Sabini gang who was successors to the Brummagem boys, the Birmingham boys, and were operating at Brighton Racecourse. And he happened to spend an evening with one of them and wrote a novel, which some say was his greatest success at that point, became a memorable film with Dickie Attenborough playing Pinky and William Hartnell.
Remade less successfully with Sam Riley.
Unfortunately, not as successfully. Mm. But it's a remarkable story. But and that's the link with Peaky Blinders. Peaky Blinders eventually lost what power they had to the Brummagem boys, then the Birmingham boys, and eventually the Birmingham boys were overtaken by the Sabini gang, who went all the way to Brighton, and therefore you have Brighton Rock. It is a seamless thread.
So there's two fictionalizations of these gangs.
Yes, absolutely.
Now and back when Graham Greene wrote his novel.
And in fact, I'm going to do a thing at the Graham Greene Festival this September, talking about the link between true crime and crime fiction.
Well, that's what we're trying to do today, isn't it?
Where are the lines? There may never have been a Pinky, just as there may never have been a Tommy Shelby, but it doesn't mean that the genesis of the idea, the genesis of the character, didn't exist.
Mm.
And that's why I think it's fascinating. And it's a very interesting subject to research, because there are a couple of people who've done a lot of work on the real Peaky Blinders.
Do you think that's because of the success of the show?
Yes. I mean, now you've got new Peaky... We've got Peaky Blinders bars, restaurants, tours, weddings, clothing line, haircuts... You know, it's spawned a complete... It's like Gavin and Stacey.
If you go to
Barry Island, there's Gavin and Stacey tour.
You're literally one of the only people who goes to Barry Island.
Yeah, I probably am, but never mind. but it's
no offence to anyone from Barry Island.
No, on the contrary. I enjoy going there. But you've got the Sabini gang eventually continuing, but in the end were crushed at Lewis Assizes in Sussex in 1948, when the majority of them were sent to jail and the whole thing petered out.
So you just stopped corruption on race courses then?
Very much so. But, you know, the difficulty, wherever there's ready money, whether it's in a pub, a pawn shop, remember betting off the course was illegal, so you had people were running bets. There was always ready money, even if it was only sixpence. Sixpence was a lot of money.
Yeah.
It wasn't. It made small change to us now. People don't even remember what sixpence is. But you put a lot of sixpences together and you get quite a lot of money. And there was always that appetite to get out of the deprivation that they were surrounded by. And just as it was true in America, in Depression America, one way of having a life was to become Bonnie and Clyde, to become...
Yeah, of course. It's very
Dillinger.
Hard to work your way out of that factory life, isn't it?
Yes. Well, in fact, in America, more often, it's the fact that there was no agriculture. You know, the Dust Bowl had destroyed Oklahoma. Mm. And you had money in banks, which you could steal. I mean...
And that's why then... Is that when people went digging for gold and stuff?
That was a little earlier.
Was that before?
Yes, a little earlier. The Klondike was 1890.
Oh,
so
interesting.
But what I would say about them is often the gangs were made up of young, unemployed white men. Quite different, say, from a gang in 2019. Quite different.
I mean, I don't know anything about gangs in 2019.
Well, let me tell you this, it's a completely different makeup. We're talking
still about territory, though. Isn't
it's still about,
and territory. I suppose about drugs a lot of the time.
Yeah, more about drugs now than it would have been.
Oh yeah, cool.
Back then. Back then, it was really just gin.
They didn't sell cocaine or anything.
No, in fact, most of them wouldn't even know what a drug was. All they knew was alcohol.
Yeah,
that was the stimulant of choice, if you like, and the way to put the horribleness of life out of your mind for a while, you know.
Mother's ruin.
Indeed. But without it, and without going back an old hobby horse of mine, without the deprivation, you would probably not have got one of the most vibrant cultures that arose out of the music hall. You've got great stars.
Jeffrey absolutely loves the music hall, guys. It's not something we've covered before, no, but it's a real love of his.
But you've got great stars, whether it was Dan Leno or Murray Lloyd, coming out of total deprivation and creating songs that live on to this day. But that's a sidebar. But what I'm saying is that the Peaky Blinders, I think, is an effort to make a point, a larger-than-life point, about something that was about deprivation in Britain's second biggest city.
And about working your way up.
Yes, and it's about...
And to be fair, he does, you know, he does want to legalise a lot of the stuff that they do. Tommy does, I mean.
Yes.
I think he's real.
Yeah, I think it's inevitable. Make any show about gangsters, whether they're in Birmingham or in Miami... There is an element of glamorisation.
I also, I'm always wary of your sweeping generalisations of women liking bad men.
No, I didn't say that this time.
No, I didn't mean... No. I just mean in the past we have discussed it.
Yes.
But Tommy Shelby is definitely like terrible person so attractive.
Yes. Well, I'm not. One historian of the time pointed out that the Peaky Blinders and the Sloggers and indeed the Brummagem Boys were really more about fighting with each other than terrorising the neighbourhood. It was much more about, this is my section of street.
Yeah.
This is my section of town and we're going to protect it and we're going to make some money out of it. It was a much smaller thing.
Oh, well, there we go.
That was
very interesting. Thanks. That was a request put in by me, so that was a totally selfish...
No, I think it's very...
It was quite nice because it didn't have so much...
Death. No. It was a real joy to do it.
We are occasionally going to try and do the real... Like the real Sopranos, another gangster situation, yeah. Or the real Hannibal Lecter, or
yes.
That kind of thing, to sort of do a little bit of crossover between fiction, crime fiction, and true crime.
Yes.
As it's of interest.
Yes, I recently reviewed the new Thomas Harris, which is the first of his novels since 1975, which doesn't include Hannibal Lecter. And he creates a new character, a new villain, and a very strong female heroine. There's no Clarice Starling in this one. This one comes from the jungle and ends up in Miami, searching for gold.
On a side note, just to say thank you, Dad, for that real Peaky Blinders. I read a book on holiday that was recommended to me called Everyone Brave is Forgiven by someone called Chris Cleave. And it's set during the Second World War. And it was just about how the war affected people. And I don't normally read war literature because I find things to do with war too sad. I'm just not very good at that kind of thing. But I absolutely loved it. It was amazing.
Wonderful. That's
it was
so
really
good.
Sad, but it was very beautiful.
Yes. Well, sad books are often beautiful.
And it made me really and sort of touched upon the Peaky Blinders in the telly programme about how war affects people. And,
yeah.
It did that really cleverly.
Yes,
it was really excellent. I highly recommend it.
Thank you, Molly. Perhaps I'll just end up by saying that among the many other things I do, apart from this wonderful podcast with Molly, is I review crime and thrillers for the Daily Mail. I make television programmes like The World's Most Evil Killers and Murder by the Sea. I've written a number of books, including the authorised biography of Frederick West, and a book called Pure Evil, which is still in your shops now.
Rush out and buy.
I take them to the live shows in the hope that one or two people will buy them.
Well, I hope so too, Dad.
Which they do, I'm pleased to say.
Well, that's excellent.
But thank you very much, darling.
Yeah, and I think probably we've got a number of people to thank also today.
Yes.
Just obviously thank you, Dad, for all your hard work as ever. Thank you to Audio Boom, who are looking after us now. Thank you to our producer, Poppy Damon, and Barney Spiegel, who's helped us with our sound. A huge help, thank you.
Yes, and thank you, Barney, for helping us out. And we're sorry about the banging, but that's the carpet layer.
Yes, sorry about the banging after all that. And thank you to my colleague, Hannah Linden, who's helped us so much with our podcast also.
Thank them all. Thank you so much.
Oh, and my brother, Dan, for doing the music.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.